Listening to The Horn, the head-on radio network.
Thank you. Thank you.
You're listening to The Horn, the Head-On Radio Network. Without having started the stream. Well, you'll catch the front end, the first 20 minutes of the program, on the rerun or on the podcast. That was a self-inflicted wound. I forgot to hit the send button. I got all wrapped up in trying to wonder when the dadgum power would come back on. Okay, so everybody, what you just missed was a brilliant disquisition on the fact that Paul Brown, Reverend Dr. Brother Representative Paul Brown, that we talked about last night, is complaining that his remarks about evolution, for which he has received a great big ration of poopy, because he sits on the Science, Space, and Technology Committee. He's complaining that those are his private thoughts, but the disquisition of the last several minutes has been over the fact that it's kind of hard to have private thoughts when you've got a microphone attached to your head that you willingly had put on your head. My apologies for the button, but there will be a complete recording, so there we go. Probably explains what, yeah. So where do we go this evening? There's lots of places to go this Thorn in the Side Thursday. We can go to Wisconsin. We can go to Australia. And the story from Australia is an inspiring one. You want to hear what it might have ought to have sounded like last week, or we hope it will sound like tonight when the repiglicking starts lying? There's a little bit of a backstory to this, and I will invite our Australian friends to straighten me out if I get this wrong. The Prime Minister of Australia is, of course, one Julia Gillard. There is a right-wing blatherhead filthmonger down there who has been pulling a Sandra Fluck on her, at one point claiming, after the recent death of Prime Minister Gillard's father, that he had died of shame. And it was sickening. It really was. It was worthy of Limbaugh. So then the right-wingers in the Australian government picked up that died of shame meme and went after the Prime Minister, saying that Australia, under her leadership, was dying of shame. Well, the leader of the conservative bunch in the Australian Parliament is one Tony Abbott. He is apparently a punk-ass prick. And he went off down the road, and it is a very sexist, misogynistic road. And this is Ms. Gillard's response. Are you paying attention, Barack? This is how you fight back when the other side gets sleazy. Joe, I know you're getting ready for prep and everything, but if you're like me, before the lights go on and everything and the music starts, you kind of like to take your mind somewhere else for a minute. Check this out.
The question is that the motion be agreed to. I call the Prime Minister.
Thank you very much, Deputy Speaker, and I rise to oppose the motion moved by the Leader of the Opposition. And in so doing, I say to the Leader of the Opposition, I will not be lectured about sexism and misogyny by this man. I will not. And the government will not be lectured about sexism and misogyny by this man. Not now, not ever. The Leader of the Opposition says that people who hold sexist views and who are misogynists are not appropriate for high office. Well, I hope the Leader of the Opposition has got a piece of paper and he is writing out his resignation. Because if he wants to know what misogyny looks like in modern Australia, he doesn't need a motion in the House of Representatives. He needs a mirror. That's what he needs. Let's go through the Opposition Leader's repulsive double standards. Repulsive double standards when it comes to misogyny and sexism. We are now supposed to take seriously that the Leader of the Opposition is offended by Mr. Slipper's text messages, when this is the Leader of the Opposition who has said, and this was when he was a minister under the last government, not when he was a student, not when he was in high school, when he was a minister under the last government. He has said, and I quote, in a discussion about women being underrepresented in institutions of power in Australia, the interviewer was a man called Stavros. The Leader of the Opposition says, if it's true, Stavros, that men have more power, generally speaking, than women, Is that a bad thing? And then a discussion ensues and another person being interviewed says, I want my daughter to have as much opportunity as my son. To which the Leader of the Opposition says, yeah, I completely agree, but what if men are by physiology or temperament more adapted to exercise authority or to issue command? Then ensues another discussion about women's role in modern society, and the other person participating in the discussion says, I think it's very hard to deny that there is an underrepresentation of women, to which the Leader of the Opposition says, but now there's an assumption that this is a bad thing. This is the man from whom we're supposed to take lectures about sexism. And then, of course, it goes on. I was very offended personally when the Leader of the Opposition, as Minister for Health, said, and I quote, abortion is the easy way out. I was very personally offended by those comments. You said that in March 2004. I suggest you check the records. I was also very offended on behalf of the women of Australia when in the course of carbon pricing campaign, the Leader of the Opposition said, when the housewives of Australia need to do what the housewives of Australia need to understand as they do the ironing. Thank you for that painting of women's roles in modern Australia. And then, of course, I was offended too by the sexism, by the misogyny of the Leader of the Opposition catcalling across this table at me as I sit here as Prime Minister. If the Prime Minister wants to, politically speaking, make an honest woman of herself, something that would never have been said to any man sitting in this chair. I was offended when the Leader of the Opposition went outside in the front of Parliament and stood next to a sign that said, ditch the witch. I was offended when the Leader of the Opposition stood next to a sign that described me as a man's bitch. I was offended by those things. Misogyny, sexism, every day from this Leader of the Opposition. Every day, in every way, across the time the Leader of the Opposition has sat in that chair and I've sat in this chair, that is all we have heard from him. And now, the Leader of the Opposition wants to be taken seriously. Apparently he's woken up after this track record and all of these statements. He's woken up and he's gone, oh dear, there's this thing called sexism. Oh, my Lord, there's this thing called misogyny. Now, who's one of them? Oh, the Speaker must be, because that suits my political purpose. Doesn't turn a hair about any of his past statements, doesn't walk into this Parliament and apologise to the women of Australia, doesn't walk into this Parliament and apologise to me for the things that have come out of his mouth, but now seeks to use this as a battering ram against someone else. Well, this kind of hypocrisy should not be tolerated, which is why this motion from the Leader of the Opposition should not be taken seriously.
Don't you kind of love that? You reckon we could maybe, could she take a 2-week vacation and maybe, oh, I don't know, get hired on as a consultant for the Obama administration? Not for the administration, but for the campaign. Isn't it nice to hear somebody with enough courage to fight back against a bunch of thugs and punks? I was talking with John Fox last night, he down in New South Wales, and me up here, and we were doing some tech stuff, and he said it's nasty. He said the misogyny is flowing in the streets down there. And, you know, all it is an extension of what's happened here. We had an outbreak of hate and misogyny, and it's running around the planet. We've got a brand new one today. Roger Rivard, or Roger Rivard? I'll need some help from the Wisconsin contingent on pronunciation, or we could just say horse's ass. He's a right-wing, pig-licking, state-level politician in Wisconsin,
He has naturally been endorsed by Paul Eddie Munster, zombie-eyed Granny Starver Ryan. And he gave an interview to the Chetek Alert newspaper about 10 months ago. It's just now coming out. But it's been discovered, and now questions are being asked about it. Come on, everybody. What was his response? 1, 2, 3. Taken out of context. On Wednesday, Rivard, horse's ass, told the Journal Sentinel the article did not provide full context of his comments and blah, blah, blah. He continues, because he's passing on the wisdom, the transgenerational wisdom of his father. Continuing to dig in the hole that he's already in, Roger Rivard, horse's ass, speaking of his father, said, he also told me one thing. If you do have premarital sex, just remember, consensual sex can turn into rape in an awful hurry. Because all of a sudden, a young lady gets pregnant, and the parents are madder than a wet hen, and she's not going to say, oh yeah, I was part of the program. All that she has to say, or the parents have to say, is it was rape because she's underage. And he just said, remember that, Roger. If you go down that road, some girls, he said, they rape so easy. Well, the whole genesis of it was advice to me telling me, if you're going to go down that road, you may have consensual sex that night, and then the next morning it may be rape. So the way he said it was, just remember, Roger, some girls, they rape so easy, it may be rape the next morning. So it's been kind of taken out of context. Because what he was quoted as saying was that some girls will portray a sexual encounter as rape if they become pregnant. This is in a colloquy in which he was asked about a recent case in Wisconsin, or a recent case in which a 17-year-old high school senior was charged with sexual assault for having sex with an underage girl in the school's band room. Some girls, they rape so easy. So I guess he's sort of getting out there with catching, you know, I don't know, carrying water for Todd Akin, because obviously that wouldn't be a legitimate rape. Hell, it might not even be forcible. Now, the zombie-eyed Granny Starver endorsed Rivard on August 9th with the following words. Roger needs to be reaffirmed to get this job done and fix the state of Wisconsin. All of a sudden now, even though the words were already out there last December, now the zombie-eyed Granny Starver has withdrawn his endorsement. Nudge, nudge, wink, wink. The zombie-eyed Granny Starver has unrung the bell with these words. From not himself, of course, but from some flapper, some talking head of his. State Representative Rivard's comments are outrageous and offensive. Congressman Ryan believes that there is no place in our discourse for rhetoric such as this. Congressman Ryan cannot support Mr. Rivard or his indefensible comments. Congressman Ryan was, of course, however, willing to sign on to a bill that talked in terms of forcible rape. Yeah, you get the idea. Ron in Raleigh writing in. He says, I like the cut of her jib, talking about Prime Minister Gillard. Is the Aussie Prime Minister related to the Iranian woman that kicked that mullah's ass? Sisters are, as I think Kate would say, if, and I'll bet she will if she's listening. In fact, she said it the night I told the story of the Iranian woman that kicked the mullah's ass. Sisters are rising up all over the place. So you get the idea what, a little bit of an idea, maybe what Thorn in the Side Thursday may be all about. There's a new, do you want to know the conspiracy of the day? I'm constantly getting these. Obama family busted in Sharia scheme. There's this clown named Tim Bueller. He's a PR flack for the right wing for Wingnut Daily, and I get these things from him every day. Yesterday it was abiotic oil and Obama's wedding ring. Since his inauguration, President Obama's family in Kenya has been on a mission to use the Obama name to transform Kenya from the nation's current Christian majority to an Islamic majority that will spread Islamic law or Sharia through the country. Just like they want to do here. And, of course, it's an invitation to interview that same flack who says that there's oil under the ground being made every day by little Keebler elves. What a freak. Jim writing in earlier this afternoon, a little bit before showtime, he said, I hope Biden reams Mr. Ryan a new one. And I think we're all hoping for that. Or at least, but it's a little disturbing because I was checking headlines before showtime to the extent that I could. And I saw a headline over at Chicken Noodle News. You're going to love this. Biden, you ever seen me rope-a-dope? The headline was, Biden's rope-a-dope strategy for debate. Asked by a reporter if his debate strategy was the boxing tactic known as rope-a-dope. Don't you love the nerdy writing? Asked by a reporter if his debate strategy was the boxing tactic known as rope-a-dope. The 69-year-old former Senator Biden replied, you ever seen me rope-a-dope? And then the nerdism kicks back. The rope-a-dope strategy was used by boxing legend Muhammad Ali in a match against the younger George Foreman in 1974 as a method of tiring out the opponent, resting against the ropes and blocking punches as the opponent wears himself out. Oh, Jesus. Water, water everywhere and not a drop to drink. Yeah, I'll probably watch the pageant. You know me. You know you will, too. Or maybe you won't. Maybe you've got better sense. Lottie noting from the chat room, they'll be sweeping Ryan up after the debate. You mean after the pageant? Yeah. No, we've got a ton of stuff this evening. God knows. Flying Spaghetti Monster knows. I tweeted one story earlier today because sometimes these things hit the interweb tubes and I see them. And it's like being pinched or stuck with a pin. You just involuntarily go, ow! And that happened to me today. Yeah. Remember when Bishop Willard Romney said people don't just die in their apartments because they get free care in the hospital? He He gave an interview to the Columbus Dispatch. That's the newspaper over in Ohio. Or a newspaper over in Ohio. And in it, he said the following. We don't have a setting across this country where if you don't have insurance, we just say to you, tough luck, you're going to die when you have your heart attack, he said as he offered more hints as to what he would put in place of Obamacare, which he has pledged to repeal. No, you go to the hospital, you get treated, you get care, and it's paid for either by charity, the government, or by the hospital. We don't have people that become ill who die in their apartment because they don't have insurance. The article continues, he pointed out that federal law requires hospitals to treat those without health insurance, although hospital officials frequently say that drives up health care costs. Well, there's a little something else attached to that, too. By treat, they mean stabilize. If your left arm goes numb and your chest hurts and you can't breathe and Ethel calls 911, or Emery calls it for Ethel, and the ambulance comes, and Emery and Ethel aren't insured. Let's say they're my age, Emery and Ethel. They'll take you to the hospital. They'll take you to the ER. They'll put the little sensor sticky hickeys on. And get your EKG. They'll take blood and see if you've got those enzymes that spell heart attack. They'll try to keep you from dying. But that's as far as it goes. Because their only obligation is to stabilize you, not to make it better. And if they can get you stabilized long enough to get you to go somewhere else and die, well, that's how the system works. Fact of the matter is, 45,000 Americans die every year because they lack health insurance. For those of you like me, too lazy to do the math, that works out to one every 12 minutes. Yeah, three people are dead for want of health insurance since this program started. Can you conceptualize that? I bet you can, because you're not a Republican, you're not a Randian, you're not a libertarian, you're not a teabagger, you're a decent human being. You're not a Republican. Oh, wait a minute. In just 2.5 more minutes, another person will have died for want of health insurance. But Bishop Willard Romney is entirely divorced and detached from all of that because he has no ability to conceptualize poverty. He has no ability to conceptualize the hellish choices made by people in this country between things like medicine and food. Because he's never been in that situation. Never. Ever. Hell, when his daddy was the head of American Motors, pimping out gremlins onto an unsuspecting public. You reckon Willard ever drove a gremlin? I'm guessing the answer's no. You go to the hospital, you get treated, you get care, it's paid for, either by charity, the government, or by the hospital. I'll be damned. I went to the wrong hospital. No, I wasn't having a heart attack. Didn't know what was happening. But I knew everything across my entire abdominal structure was in agony. And it sure felt like death could be imminent. Although it's hard to say what that feels like. It was miserable. It turned out I was in the hospital for less than 48 hours. Didn't have a lick of insurance. And yeah, they treated me. They did not, however, make me better. Because we finally got a diagnosis. Congratulations, Bob. Your gallbladder is rotten. At which point I said, so are we just going to run in and take it out? No. And you know why the no was, right? Because all they had to do was stabilize me. And in this case, stabilizing me meant making sure I didn't eat anything for a nice long while. Loading me up with some morphine. Making sure my blood pressure didn't take the top of my skull off. And waiting till the pain went away enough that they could send me home. And that's why I went, ah! When I ran across the line about, you get care and it's paid for. Bullshit. Sorry, but I mean, really. I'd like to sit down across a table from the bishop and just explain this to him. Because I got a bill for $15,000 for that less than 48 hours in the hospital. And it's my bill. It's not the hospital's bill. It's not charity's bill. It's not the government's bill. It is my bill. It is my bill to deal with from now until the end of time, because that's about how long it's going to take to pay off. The surgery itself that would fix it, that comes in somewhere between $5,000 and $10,000. I don't have a bill for that. I just can't get it done. So as I said in my little tweet earlier today, that kind of statement from that detached, disassociated, otherwise disinterested, parasitic, 1% Frankenstein-looking monstrosity is personally offensive to me. Personally offensive. And I will dare say, while I'm generally not in the business of saying this kind of thing, it should be personally offensive to you. Because in light of the fact that he hopes to leave 72 million American citizens without health care if he should be elected president, then out of a nation of some 330 million, that's a little less than a third. One in three. That means that if you're not one of them, odds are very strong you know one or two. If you're listening to the program, you know at least one. Given the makeup of the Horn family, you probably know a lot. And so, while he will lecture through that surgical incision-looking smirk of his about how the bills are paid by charity or the hospital or the government, he is a damnable liar when he says it. And I've got the collection agency calls to prove it. I've got the collection agency letters to prove it. The fourth person has died this hour for want of health insurance. Just check the clock there. you know, January the 1st, 2014 has become a very important date for me. If we can just make it to January the 1st, 2014, if we can just keep this Frankenstein-looking freak of privilege from entering the White House, then maybe, just maybe, and I realize this is selfish on my part, but it's not just me, but maybe, on January the 1st, 2014, I might qualify. For Medicaid. If, and it's a mighty big if, of course, if the Medicaid expansion is approved in this state, if the coal bosses who control the political candidates who are likely to win the governor's race give them permission to. He lives in an alternate reality, Bishop Willard Romney. He lives in a world where you and I are an invisible annoyance. We don't even rise to the level of annoyance. We're just invisible. You know, out there getting sick and going to the emergency room and having the bill paid for by charity or the government or the hospital. You know, I said I'd like to sit down across a table from him and explain it to him. I wouldn't. I wouldn't cross the street to explain it to him. I wouldn't piss down that man's throat if his godforsaken guts were on fire. And that's the truth. Because there's nothing to say to a person who will just sit and tell lies for his own advancement, his own sick ambition. And it is sick. It is sicker or as sick as those whom he would callously leave to die. They want to talk about death panels. Well, there he is. If someone is willing to simply pretend that the problem doesn't exist, the process by which that pretense is arrived at is as sure as God made little green apples and they'll give you the runs if you eat too many of them, a death panel. 4 more minutes. 4 more minutes. And the fifth American will have died during this program for want of access to health care, for want of health insurance. We're a tough lot, us proles, you know. We'll take more than the 1% could ever stand. Oh, Muffy, I've got a hangnail. Oh, schedule me at the... Oh, get me to the Mayo. We go to work feeling like hell. We go to sleep in pain. We cough and wonder if it's the beginning of cancer or emphysema. Our chests hurt, and we wonder if we're going to see the next birthday. But you know what we do? For as long as we can, we keep going. There is more character in the toenail clippings of a member of the working poor than in the entire miserable corporal mass of Bishop Willard Romney. Benedict in the chat room with a story. A friend died from gangrene after he was stabilized and released for a severe gash on his leg. Seems they weren't required to provide the antibiotics he needed, and since he couldn't work with his injury, he couldn't afford them himself. Benedict worrying if there are enough doctors available, Bob, who will see the new influx of Medicaid patients, something that's almost a joke to imagine. No, there aren't enough doctors. I haven't, with the exception of the one I saw in the hospital, I haven't seen one in years. What we will get is a visit or a consultation with a certified physician's assistant or a certified nurse practitioner. But that's another discussion entirely. That's the stranglehold that the American Medical Association has on entry into its guild. But something is better by far than nothing. So we've got about a minute before the hour. It's thrown in the side Thursday. I've been wondering where the Green News Report is lately. I didn't see it. Maybe they're on break. But we'll take a little break. It gives us an opportunity to light up the phone lines. Got a couple of lights going. Open lines if you want to jump in. You know the number. 877-443-2366. On your nickel, 304-658-3333. If you want to reach me by email, of course, it's easy. I was reminded today that I don't give out the email address often enough. Bob Kincaid, BobKincaid, BobKincaid@gmail.com. So, we make it as easy as possible. Run on over to the chat room. Check that out if you want to. HeadOnRadioNetwork.com/chatroom. It's easy to get in. Just register there. Your registration for the horn generally is not what gets you into the chat room. It's a separate gig. Just jump into the chat room. You're listening to listener-supported. And we are now at $180 for this evening that we need to come in. Thank you for the kind contribution. This is listener-supported conversation radio of a liberal, progressive nature. 7 years now, or almost, this is The Horn. I'm Bob Kincaid.
Everybody's free, got to sit down. But if the last of the blue blood to grease her bars, and all is painted in wintertime, and married with three kids, cut by the river, and sell the slow straight down the line, and son of the
preparing for the future of our children, our grandchildren, and our wild, wonderful West Virginia. Developing our renewable energy resources is the best way to ensure a clean, sustainable way of life and safe, good-paying jobs for generations to come. Here in the Mountain State, our most abundant energy resource is the wind. Our ridges and majestic mountain peaks shape and direct the wind like stones in a mountain stream. Coal River Mountain is the ideal place for developing wind power. The Coal River Mountain Wind Farm will provide us with a source of clean energy and good jobs forever. We have the power to make our future happen now. Be a part of the clean energy solution for West Virginia by visiting coalriverwind.org or call 304-854-2182. That's coalriverwind.org, 854-2182.
Bubble Genius. It's not your mother's soap.
Hey, dude, wait 1 second. It's totally my mother's soap.
Bubble Genius. It's not your father's soap.
No. See, right here, I've got soap for my dad.
And you know what? It's not just soap. Look, stuff for my dog.
Holy crap! There's even stuff for all my pregnant friends.
And hippies.
And hey, dude, loosen that tie. Try it again.
Bubble Genius. You got your soap right here.
And got your bad, bad, bad body stuff.
www.bubblegenius.com.
This is the Media Matters Minute. I'm Angelo Carasone. Mother Jones released a video of Mitt Romney from a May 2009 fundraiser where he praises Glenn Beck.
A man who is really making an impact in our entire country today. My friend and a statesman in his own right, Glenn Beck.
Beck was a couple months into his Fox News show around the time the video was shot. Let's see what he was saying that earns him such high praise.
Their fearless leader, Comrade Obama,
the Manchurian candidate, couldn't destroy us faster than Barack Obama.
And who could forget the time Beck pretended he was the president pouring gasoline on an average American?
President Obama, why don't you just set us on fire? For the love of Pete, what are you doing?
Finally, while discussing the nomination of Sonia Sotomayor to the Supreme Court.
It's like, hey, Hispanic chick lady, you're empathetic? She says, yep. They say, you're in.
For more on this and other stories, please visit MediaMatters.org.
It's your second hour in the Liberal Sandbox, and you're head-on with Bob Kincaid.
Hour two, underway. I'm Bob. This is The Horn. We are now at $160. For this evening's fundraising goal, thanks to the kind contribution that came in during the break. It is exactly what keeps all of this going. And what do you say? Let's go straightway to the phones, shall we? And let the conversation begin now that the filibobstering has ended. Hey, welcome to the program.
Hi, Bob. It's Harry in D.C.
Oh, hey, Harry. How are you?
Good. How are you, sir?
Hanging on, hanging in.
Yeah. Well, listen, before I say anything, I hope I'm saying something that other listeners would also, in the Horn family, would also like to say. I just wanted to, you know, really honor you for doing this program night after night, you know, considering all of the circumstances, stresses, and, you know, limited resources under which you are doing this program. I mean, to me, you know, I mean, you're not even, in a sense, up in the airwaves, you know, on a terrestrial radio station. And yet, at least from my point of view, you know, your program is at least for me at the moment, probably the best radio program, progressive radio program there is on this planet.
Thank you very, very kindly, Harry. That means a tremendous amount.
Well, and I'm not, you know, saying this. It's not this.
Oh, no. You're not shining at all. No, I know that.
No, I'm not. No, in fact, I'm a terrible brown noser. But, no, I really mean it. And for me, this program has meant a great deal since I started listening to it several months ago. And I just, you know, hearing you talk about your, you know, your health care bills and, of course, as I've mentioned to you in an email, I myself am very frustrated with the healthcare system and have problems dealing with healthcare and health insurance. But
Harry, I hope we can all understand that I don't do this as a means of trying to solicit anyone's sympathy.
I didn't think
you were, but I want to clarify that.
Yeah.
What I'm trying to do is, let me see if I can put this coherently. I have a microphone, and this microphone, which means, you know, going back to Reverend Brother Representative Dr. Brown, this is not private. This is a public conversation.
Right.
And that's all I've ever wanted it to be. And with that in mind, there are thousands, millions of people
in this country who don't have a microphone, who are in circumstances far worse than mine. And there are very few in the government of the United States, none on the Republican side, who give a damn whether they live or die.
Yes, and you're right.
And to that end, if I can voice a little bit of that, then I think maybe I'm doing something worthwhile.
Yeah. Well, in fact, I was sort of trying to get there, which is to say that I think it's admirable that you are, you know, even in a sense willing to talk about your own health, your own terrible dealings with the health care, quote, system, because, you know, I myself, you know, think that our system is completely broken. But you, as you said, you have a microphone, and I think that people do appreciate the fact that you are, you know, speaking out about it. You know, and I agree with you completely. And you know, I'm certainly a strong advocate of a single payer healthcare system because I just think the system is not only broken, but it is now being so influenced by our current culture of greed that there is no way that it is going to, in a sense, function, you know, even adequately for the, you know, for all the citizenry of this country.
And the thing is, Harry, there is a segment of this country that doesn't want it to.
Yes, and you're probably right about that. Although I hate to think about that aspect, but I'm sure you're right.
You know, when Bishop Willard says, "Well, we don't want you to just sit there and die."
Yeah.
Well, what he's saying is, yes, he does.
Yeah.
Yes, they do.
Yeah. Right.
Alan Grayson was right. The Republican health care plan is don't get sick, and if you do get sick, die quickly.
Yes. Absolutely, yes. And Alan Grayson has said it very succinctly, and I agree. You know, and frankly, I this is actually not why I called tonight, but I just did want to you know, honor you for that, and particularly in terms of what you said about having a microphone. I think it's you know, what you're doing is very admirable to, you know, in a sense, keep this in front of everybody, because certainly, you know, and I don't know why people are not talking about this every day, but certainly this healthcare system issue is really, as you just, you know, in a sense, said in other words, you know, is one of the really core issues of this election, and yet somehow it keeps getting pushed to the side a little bit.
And I think that's only because the people who are most affected by it, Harry, have no power, have no voice,
You're
have
probably
no say.
Right. And so, again, it's, you know, all I can do, I guess, is stand back and admire you for taking the microphone and being willing to, you know, give voice to that. I don't know what else I can say except that I am so grateful to you for, you know, using your microphone for that purpose.
Thank you, Harry. Thank you kindly.
The reason I called, and this is, I suppose, it is related, but maybe in a more general way, and I hope you and your listeners can kind of hang on with me. I was specifically calling in sort of to follow up or in response to your caller of last night, Carol from Las Vegas.
Yes.
And if you recall, he was, well, first, I mean, he called in particular to talk about how moved he was by the Mr. Rogers, the audio of the videotape that, you know, Fred Rogers' testimony in front of the Senate committee, I guess it was 1969.
Yes.
And he was talking about how, you know, the power, in a sense, of what Fred Rogers did that day in that Senate committee hearing room, and you know, how he was saying that, I don't have exact words, but he was saying, wouldn't we have a much better society if, you know, if there were more Mr. Rogers and people were raised with the kinds of things that Mr. Rogers was talking about and under his influence. And the fact is that, I know you've been to Washington, D.C., so you know this. The fact is that, you know, even still on Capitol Hill, certainly back in 1969, Capitol Hill, you know, is still a place where I would say where sort of macho values still reign supreme. You know, it's very important on Capitol Hill to appear powerful and tough and, you know, all that, and then, you know, not to be show your vulnerability or certainly not your emotional vulnerability, et cetera. And I was very struck. I actually went back and looked at the videotape of Fred Rogers' testimony and watched it again twice because there, and I think this is what Carol was getting to, there was something very, in a sense, unusual about what he did as he was sitting there testifying in front of a, you know, a Senate committee. And I just wanted to, if I may, I just wanted to talk about that a little bit and sort of parse it out.
Please.
Because, I'm sorry?
Please do.
Yeah. Well, example. Well, and we can just start with the start. The fact is that Fred Rogers, from the start, first of all, you know, I mean, here we are in this, as I said, you know, Capitol Hill, a Senate committee hearing room, which, as I said, has always been and still is, I think, suffused with, you know, too much sort of too much of the macho ideal, and you know, and everyone needing to prove how tough and you know macho they are about you know these big and powerful policy decisions that supposedly Congress is making. And he starts out, you know, in this very, in a sense, very kind of conversational, very soft voice that I guess is his trademark, but doesn't try to change it for his testimony as a, you know, some people might. Anybody who's watched a Senate committee hearing knows that, you know, when people are testifying and sitting there in front at a table in front of a Senate committee, usually there's great tension and the person testifying is doing his or her best to, you know, try to appear, you know, firm and, you know, having convictions, et cetera. And Fred Rogers starts a little bit different. And he talks about the fact that he wrote this 10-minute statement, but then he says, you know, he says it's a philosophical statement, and it's probably too long to read, so I'm not going to read it to you. But then he says, but you know, he says, it's something that I care very, very much about. He says something like, you know, it's very important to me. He says that what I wrote in this, you know, a philosophical statement. And then he talks about trust, and he says to Senator Pastore, he says, and I trust you, and I trust that, you know, you will read this. So that's why I'm not going to read it through now. And Pastore, who at that point, you know, seems like this kind of gruff, sort of typical Senate chair, says, well, do you want to read the whole thing anyway? And Fred Rogers says, no, no, actually, I really don't. I just would like to talk about it. And so he's already, you know, in a sense, said, well, here I have this philosophical statement, and I got to say, I think it's rare in a Senate hearing to have somebody talk about a philosophical statement that they've written, and rare then for somebody to start talking about how, you know, personally important something is and how much they care about what it is that they said. And from there, you know, he starts talking about, really, you know, in a sense, talking directly about the fact that, and it's not, he doesn't, he's not really, you know, he's not talking in Washington policy terms. He's talking sort of in more personal or kind of conversational terms about children and what he tries to do with his show. And, you know, and at first you can see Senator Pastore seems a little impatient and gruff and everything, but, you know, as of course it turns out, particularly when Mr. Fred Rogers gets to the song that he, you know, has written himself. I mean, there's a discussion where Senator Pastore asks, you know, how long the program is, writes everything, and it turns out, you know, the Fred Rogers, of course, hosts and writes everything, including the script and all the songs. And you can see Senator Pastore kind of, you know, being a little impressed by this. And then, you know, Fred Rogers recites that song about feelings and about how you can stop and also
what do you do with the mad that you feel?
Exactly. What do you do with, and which he then, and he makes a point of pointing out that this was a direct quote from a child that he had in a small group that he was working with. And he then goes on to recite, which is really a wonderful thing. And I then, you know, and I was wondering also why Senator Pastore seemed so, you know, moved by it and talked about goosebumps. And I did a little research on him. And
you too? Me too.
Excuse me? Did you?
Yeah.
Ah, okay. So you know what I'm about to say. And, of course, your listeners may not, and maybe I'll just try to say it briefly. You know, he was, even though he comes across in that tape as a typical kind of gruff, you know, powerful senator, in fact, he came from very unexpected circumstances. He was the first Italian-American elected governor of any state and the first Italian-American elected senator of any state. Of course, he's from Rhode Island. I shouldn't say of course, but that is certainly where there's a large Italian-American community. And he also, in fact, was very short. He was about 5'4". And and he apparently said that because, and he grew up, he lost his father at age 9 and grew up under relatively poor circumstances. He had to take care of the other children, his brothers and sisters, younger brothers and sisters after his father died. And so he apparently rose by, you know, dint of great desire to make something of himself and eventually got into politics and was certainly often known as a very sort of known, I guess, for having a booming voice and for being very dramatic and for debating and all that. And so, of course, in this tape, he originally, you know, initially does come across that way, you know, as this kind of gruff, powerful, oh, you know, and of course, and also he was known for dressing impeccably, and you can sort of see in the tape there, you know, that his hair is slicked back and he has this very nicely trimmed mustache. He looks very, you know, kind of gentlemanly.
Dignified.
Yeah, very dignified, right. And I think, I don't remember if this is true, but I seem to recall he may be wearing a pinstripe suit, so, or something like it. And he just looks very typical Washington and powerful. And yet he's so moved. And of course, you know, I mean, certainly there's great power in what Fred Rogers is saying. And I agree with that. And I'm not in any way trivializing that. But you realize also that here is this senator who normally feels he probably has to conduct himself in a very gruff and kind of booming way in order to get respect in the Senate. But, you know, what Fred Rogers says is almost too much for him. It sort of melts him a little bit. You know, and I guess that's what I found so powerful.
I thought the whole dynamic was fraught with both emotion and charged with a sort of power that one. It is an extraordinary moment, especially
yes,
for something like a committee hearing. Among other things, the homework that I did about Senator story.
Yeah.
When he was governor of Rhode Island, he signed into law Rhode Island's first ever corporate income tax.
Yes. Well, you're right. I yes.
So, among other things, became concerned about water pollution in Rhode Island. He was very much ahead of his time.
Yes, he was.
And he was, of course, I guess we'd call him a progressive Democrat. Democrats
also
were progressive once upon a time.
Yes, and you also may have realized this. I just wanted to make sure we added this in. He was also very concerned about nuclear power.
Yeah.
And, you know, nuclear test bans and things like that.
And so by the time that committee hearing rolled around, the $20 million for PBS had been suggested by LBJ on the way out. And you may recall when I played that clip a couple of nights ago, I specifically referenced the fact that this talk about teaching children ways of being other than violence and subjecting them to just a little bit of gentle, decent teaching as opposed to the constant, what was then deemed a constant barrage of violence on television that has now been multiplied exponentially and compounded.
Right.
The cut that Richard Nixon had suggested back to $10 million, which would have effectively nullified any hopes of growth that PBS had.
Yeah.
Nixon asked for that cut, and I mentioned, like I said, the Vietnam War. Nixon asked for that cut in that recommended $20 million specifically because of the money he was spending on the Vietnam War. He wanted that $10 million to go into bombs to drop on brown people.
Yes, right. No, sure. I mean, yes.
And so Frank Pastore, I think some of it was a bit of theatrics. You know, that coming across all gruff and what are you doing here and, you know, I'm too busy and, you know, well, would it make you happy if you read the damn thing? You know, that kind of, you know, because he knew Nixon was watching. Nixon watched everybody.
Right.
Nixon was a raving paranoid.
Yes, he was. Yes. No, you're absolutely correct.
And so when a man of that kind of gruff demeanor makes it clear that he has been moved,
yes,
then it moves others as well. And the proof is in the pudding, Harry, insofar as not only in the following budget did they get their $20
million,
PBS got $22 million.
Yes, I saw that. And the other thing that struck me was, and they, I don't know if you happened to research the New York Times obituary on him, but which didn't talk much about the Fred Rogers hearing, but at the end... they said that Senator Pastore could also poke fun of himself. And they gave one example. He said he once observed that nuclear fallout might bring bizarre changes. And this is a quote. Mutations, he thundered, quote. Perhaps they'll make Pastore 6 feet tall. You know, because he was only 5 foot four, and obviously bothered him his entire life.
Well, you know, it is funny, or well, it is ironic to me, I suppose, Harry,
yeah,
that that out of everything, we are still talking, out of all the lies that Bishop Willard Romney told,
yeah,
we're still talking about the Big Bird business.
Well,
and about and it's,
well, there's something, I guess, maybe, you know, sort of, I don't know, there's some sort of meta, something, you know, some kind of meta symbolism about that. I mean, and maybe because indeed, you know, it resonates with people who either were, you know, brought up with Mr. Rogers or with Sesame Street. Now, I actually was, I grew up in a time when really neither was dominant on PBS, but I've certainly seen, you know, both shows.
Well, this is an anniversary today. I suppose this or maybe yesterday,
yeah,
was the anniversary of Captain Kangaroo's debut on the air in 1955.
Ah, yes, and of course I did watch Captain Kangaroo, yes.
And he was doing similar stuff. He had a tremendous degree of respect for the mental acuity of children and did not like to insult their intelligence.
No, absolutely. That was also a wonderful show for anyone who may have seen it or remember it.
But, you know, I've referenced on the program the number of flack emails that I get. I mean, my email inbox is just polluted.
Sure. Yeah.
There's an outfit out there called No Labels. They were going to be the big movement in this election season that was going to find us a way around the partisan political divide.
Oh, I had, well, I, vaguely, I, yeah, I don't remember.
Well, they're still out there, and they're still sending out emails. I got one from them today.
Yeah.
It reads, and I won't go through the whole thing.
Yeah.
It reads as follows, Harry. Big Bird, really? We're $16 trillion in debt and weeks away from going over the fiscal cliff that could crash our economy, and the debates are about Big Bird? It's incredibly frustrating, but no labels has specific, realistic, common-sense plans. And their specific common-sense plans involve pretending that Republicans don't behave like Republicans do. And see, I hate this kind of equivocation, Harry, because it suggests that somehow there's something wrong with those of us on the progressive side who think that Big Bird and PBS are damned well worth fighting over.
Well, you mentioned the word equivocation. Maybe you're being diplomatic. I mean, to me, it is, in a sense, a sign of contempt, you know, kind of cultural contempt.
I agree.
For progressive people who believe in things other than just, you know, whether enough money is being made. Or, I mean, when I say enough, or whether an excessive, you know, enough enough excessive money is being made and things like that. And this is why, you know, to me, Even, you know, watching again this tape of Fred Rogers is, to me, was not only just a moment in a hearing, but also sort of a culture. Well, I think you may have already, of course, I'm sure you said this already, a cultural moment in time. I mean, an important, precious cultural moment. And I think that's why when one listens to it, even what just listens to the audio, I think one is so moved. You know, at least I was. And, you know, when I watched the tape the two additional times, both times, again, I was moved, even though I knew what was coming.
And I think that's because it's genuine.
Yeah, oh, very genuine. And that's sort of, I guess, where I'm going. And if you allow me to go a little further along.
Sure.
Which, again, is not, I'm sorry, it's not about the debate. I'm sorry, it's not about, you know.
I don't think anybody wants to talk about the pageant tonight.
No, and I'm sorry, you know, certainly, you know, all of the evils of Mitt Romney, you know, to me are still all there. I don't care what's going on with the polls or anything else. I'm sorry. The man is evil, and, the whole Republican campaign is evil, I'm scared to death. But anyway, this is just one last thing about Senator Vastori. The Times obituary also, there's one last joke, which is that he, and I think this is why, Bob, you could say that indeed he was a kindred spirit. The last line in the obituary is, and he, meaning Senator Vastori, expressed gratitude that his parents had anglicized his first name. And then there's a quote. It says, quote, "If they had called me Giovanni," he said, "my initials would be G-O-P." Which I thought was just priceless. So, you know, there was a lot more there than even, you know, when you first watch this, as I say, at least to me, you know, you think, oh, yeah, here's another senator being obnoxious, you know, because he's chair of a committee. But, in fact, you know, Senator Vastori was a much more complicated person, and perhaps that's why also, there was, as you said, that kind of interactive theater that made that moment so precious. But what I wanted to say was your caller Carol, I think also said something to the effect that, you know, he wished that there were sort of more people like Mr. Rogers around, and Fred Rogers, you know, he somehow grew up as a man in a way that, and I suppose it may have been because of his interest in children, but I also think it's because of one or two relatives he had when he was growing up, that he just seemed to be so much more interested. Well, he was certainly very interested in the insides of children and thought that that was important to not only to children, but in a sense to their growing up and to the kind of society, therefore, those children would, you know, create and maintain when they became adults. And I, about 6 months ago, and I won't explain why, I actually was collecting some things that Fred Rogers had said, some of them on his shows, and I'm just going to, if I might, read just one or two of them.
Because sure.
It shows you the kind of person he was trying to be for the children on his show and for the children he worked with. And they're both very short. This one says, "When I was a boy and I would see scary things in the news, my mother would say to me, 'Look for the helpers. You will always find people who are helping.'" And he says, "To this day, especially in times of disaster, I remember my mother's words, and I'm always comforted by realizing that there are still so many helpers, so many caring people in this world." And I think about that a lot, you know, his mother saying, "Look for the helpers," because, you know, so many times in crises and disasters we have, you know, we don't.
And he was very much a Christian man, and I don't take any issues with his Christianity.
No, I don't either, actually. And here's just one more. He says, "Try your best to make goodness attractive. That's one of the toughest assignments you'll ever be given."
Wow.
Yeah, I thought that was just precious. But it, you know, it, I guess what concerns me, and this is sort of where I'm going with this, if I may, for a few more minutes, I'm concerned that the culture, at least at this point in time, and I'm not saying that we've never been there before, but the culture, we that the kind of person Fred Rogers was and grew up to be and also was allowed to be, in a sense, in his vocation, I do worry that we are, in a sense, squeezing that kind of person out, or that our culture, or certainly the political climate right now, is squeezing that person out. Particularly, and I'll say this, and of course I'm biased, but particularly, you know, if one is a man, and you know, this is why I go back to the tape, where I think that Fred Rogers was so willing to express his feelings and be emotional, you know, in a what should have been otherwise a as usual that you'd normally encounter.
Well, you know, I think his is a character type.
Yeah.
If I may.
Yeah.
In reading it, because I did, I ran off and read biographical stuff about him and watched other videos and so forth.
Yeah.
Of course, I grew up as a child watching his show from time to time.
Yeah.
But I was already in grade school by the time Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood hit full swing. But you'd still see it in the evenings and the afternoons. And even as a kid, and we become as children very jaded very early on, I remember thinking, this is a little too soft.
Yeah, well,
but you know, for a younger child, it was not. I had already been somewhat hardened by my early elementary school experience, which involved, among other things, running until I was blue in the face home to keep from getting the shits kicked out of me by the schoolyard bullies.
Yeah, right.
I was a smart kid, and smart kids were there for smart kids were put on the planet to be beaten by the strong kids.
Right. Well, you know, even Fred Rogers told a story about being attacked by bullies.
Where was I going with this? It's a type. It's a type. Yeah.
Yeah.
That gentleness of spirit, in reading all the biographical information I read about him, Harry, you know who the first person that came to mind was?
No, but please.
And this is going to be a little weird coming from a recovering Southern Baptist. The first person that came to mind for me was St. Francis of Assisi.
Mm, okay. Mm-hmm. I can see that.
Not Christ, but St. Francis.
Mm-hmm.
After that, I thought of the Buddha.
Mm-hmm.
And there are people who move among us from time to time who are not cut from the same cloth as most of us.
Yeah.
He was never, Fred Rogers was never ashamed to let young people and their parents know that it was okay not to be completely submerged in the notion of authoritarianism.
Right. Right.
And again, I think that was, you know, to a Richard Nixon, to the Republicans in general, that is a dangerous idea.
Well, it's also a way of living and a person, you know, way of being as a person that is a dangerous thing as well.
Right. That's what I mean.
Point. But, you know, I mean, I have here right in front of me, this is one from this compilation of things that he once said. I mean, he talks about himself, you know, being bullied in school. He says, when I was a kid, I was shy and overweight. I was a perfect target for ridicule. And he said, he was harassed and got beaten, and he said, the advice I got from the grown-ups was, just let on, you don't care, then nobody will bother you. But he says, what I actually did was mourn. I cried to myself whenever I was alone. I cried through my fingers as I made up songs on the piano. I sought out stories of other people who were poor in spirit, and I felt for them.
St. Francis.
Well, okay, I'm not going...
Well, no, because I mean, you don't, as an adult, you don't use a phrase like poor in spirit simply because it comes to you. Using a phrase like that, you know, he was tapping into something in the Jesus tradition.
Yes,
blessed are the poor in spirit. You know,
yes.
Blessed are the meek.
Right.
And you know, he apparently took all of that to heart, that Yeshua, the brown-skinned Palestinian day laborer, really did mean that stuff.
Yes.
you know, blessed are the peacemakers, for they shall, and there's the kingdom of God, they shall see God, theirs is the kingdom of heaven, the meek shall inherit the earth, you know, or the peacemakers, yeah, right.
Right. No, I see what you're saying, I can see the point. No, I understand what you're saying. I guess, though, I also want to say, though, that, you know, that there are, that culture can encourage or discourage, you know, certain kinds of either inner or outer, you know, behavior and values. And I guess that's what worries me, or what contrast I saw when I watched Fred Rogers again in front of the Senate committee. You know, because I am worried about a culture that, you know, and I've mentioned this, I guess, once before when I talked with you on the air, you know, about the rise again of a kind of social Darwinism. And, you know, in fact, I, as you may recall, I sent you an article by a cultural critic, a professor now in Canada, who was talking about what he calls economic Darwinism, and he says that, the policies of the last four decades have given way to an economic Darwinism that promotes a politics of cruelty. And that's what really concerns me above all. I mean, what happens when the people like Fred Rogers or even his mother, when they're not around to say, you know, look for the helpers, or, you know, you don't have to, you know, you don't have to be powerful. You don't have to have all the power. You don't have to have all the money. You don't have to act like, you know, you're this hyper-masculine, you know, person.
Right.
That you're more fit than others to survive because you're tough. You don't have to be that way.
And frankly, I think we're living some of that, Harry, because there is... right wing and the Tea Partiers and the libertarians and the usual suspects. They're doing all they can to stamp out anyone and any manifestation of anything except brute force.
Yeah.
And of course, to extend into our discussion about fascism last night, fascism exists by brute force. There is no nuance in fascism.
Yes, right.
And to my eye, and I don't say that, you know, there goes that Bob, he's a name calling again. When I say that Republicans are fascists, I'm not calling them names. I am describing their political philosophy as they themselves have defined it.
Yes, and I see what you're saying, and I agree with you that it is indeed a philosophy and a way of behaving not only themselves, but as you said, but in a sense towards others. And you see, but I guess you see the problem is that this is what I find so scary, and I wonder why other people or some other people don't find it. You know, why some people don't seem to be scared by it. Because frankly, you know, as a relatively sensitive person myself, I really am, I'm scared of Bishop Brock.
You have a right to be.
I'm scared of Paul Ryan. I'm scared of, you know, even though we make fun of her, now Michelle Bachmann. I mean, these people to me are scary people who indeed I fear, in a sense, could decide that I am too, you know, maybe too weak or too vulnerable or
too unproductive
or too sensitive or too thoughtful or too questioning or whatever, and that they don't want me around anymore. And,
I was about to ask you, you know, it's one thing to say I am afraid of. It is another to be able to verbalize why. Willard Romney? Why do we fear? And if I may suggest an answer, Harry, I think it's not just what we feel about ourselves, but what we suspect in them is a willingness to blithely look the other way while an entire segment of the citizenry, not the population, not the people, the citizenry, is reduced to ashes.
Yes, you are. Well, I appreciate your saying that because I think you're correct. And, you know, we sometimes talk about, you know, people in positions of power now as if, and if they see, you know, if they're selfish, we call them narcissistic or sociopathic. But I would say that, you know, I frankly, at least the top of the Republican Party and the people, you know, the billionaires behind them, to me, are psychopaths. And they would look the other way. And they would perhaps want me out of the way, whether it was because of the personality attributes I have or the fact even that I'm Jewish. And again, I'm not saying that I would be the only minority group that would be
The Jewish people have some of that fresh in their minds.
They do indeed.
Or maybe they've just got 3,000 years worth of it in their minds.
They do indeed. You know, and I remember last night you and Jim were talking about Kristen Locke and the difference, and you were distinguishing between that and sort of this crusade that you this crusade against Islam and the vision of the vengeful Christ. I agree with that. I mean, I agree that there's a distinction, but I certainly know that, you know, what Hitler was doing in Germany, as one author I know, as a Jewish author, has said, it was basically, as he put it, in a sense, it was a public hygiene project. And what he meant was, or a public health project, and what he meant was that Hitler and the people, you know, who somehow were able, why, I don't know, were crazy enough to agree with him, basically decided that Jews and others, including, you know, homosexuals and gypsies and others, were basically not human. They were vermin. You know, they were mice. They were cockroaches. They were rats. And so therefore, you know, to clean up Germany, you needed to basically clean out those people because they were vermin. And so it was, as this author said, it was a public health initiative.
That's very true.
Yeah, and frankly, that resonates with me in terms of, I hate to say it, but in terms of the current Republican Party leadership and what they say. And, if, you know, not just making, you know, projecting onto them thing, it's based on what they say. You know, I'm not from the South. I grew up in the, you know, Northeast. Whether it's South or whether they're from the Midwest, like, you know, Michelle Bachmann or whatever, it is very scary to realize that, you know, in various places in this country, we have these people with power, you know, who are congressmen or senators or whatever, or a few billionaires, and like that Mr. Siegel that was talked about last night, who I'm probably ashamed to say is probably Jewish, but, you know, these people who really would like to get rid of others of us, you know, and I that's to me why this election is so, so scary, even though, you know, I do occasionally somebody will say to me, you know, why are you taking it so seriously? Well, it's because of what I see as that psychopathology and that, in fact, I would also say that there's in a sense this, almost kind of, way in which empathy has been squeezed out somehow of the Republican Party. In other words, empathy obviously is completely verboten, taboo.
Well, if you heard that Media Matters minute, you heard that snide remark from Glenn Beck.
Yes, absolutely.
About
right.
Sonia Sotomayor saying yes. That she had a degree of empathy.
Yes,
and again, that is, you know, that is to be derided. That is to be mocked.
Right, and what's so really, I think, horrific about that is that, I mean, people who study empathy, there's a guy in Britain named Simon Baron Cohen who studies both autism and empathy, and I mean, you can probably see the connection because, you know, some people who are autistic, not because it's their fault, but just because of their wiring, have trouble being empathetic. But he talks about the fact that there are sort of what he calls negative empathy or negative, you know, lack of empathy and positive lack of empathy. Somebody who is autistic, in a sense, cannot help it. But someone who is a psychopath or a clinical narcissist, you know, their lack of empathy is because of, you know, in a sense, a deep, well, both wounds and, you know, personality disorder. And those people are dangerous because they don't have that empathy. And he, you know, Baron Cohen says that empathy is the most, he says it's the most valuable natural resource in the entire world. And why would he say that, except that, in a sense, empathy is what gives us, you know, community and civilization and people being good to
each other. It is the only thing that allows us to think more broadly than
outside ourselves.
Our own narrow self-interests.
Yeah. And I, for the like of me, I can't find much, if any, empathy in the Republican presidential campaign of 2012.
No, it's not there. I mean, you've got Willard Romney, who we have presented a crushing brief against in terms of being able to even comprehend that we exist.
Yeah.
And then you've got Paul Ryan, who, and I don't mean to reduce everything to the religious, Harry. I apologize if it seems that way.
Oh, no, it doesn't. No, but of course,
but
you know, I
Paul Ryan comes from that hardcore right-wing school of the Roman Catholic Church that ignores the social teachings of Jesus and that despises, among other things, the reforms of Vatican II.
Yeah.
And they are a growing body, and they are to be feared.
Yeah.
Again, for the same reasons of fear that that we touched on earlier. Harry, this has been a magnificent conversation. The lights are lit up, and
I think we should probably
go forward.
Absolutely.
I thank you again very much, and I hope things get better for you.
Well, thank you, and it was wonderful to talk with you.
It was wonderful for me as well. Thank you, Harry.
Okay.
Take care.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye now. Harry, our buddy calling from the D.C. area. You know, there's a certain the goddess is a goddess of irony. And sometimes it works in your favor, and sometimes it works against you. Along about the time I started talking about Willard Romney and my $15,000 hospital bill for the problem that didn't get fixed, that problem re-presented itself. And I'm just going to tell you what's going on here. I am in incredible pain. From about my sternum, or from about my solar plexus down. And I recognize this pain. It's the same pain that I've been through before. It is probably self-inflicted. I had chicken salad for dinner. Delicious chicken salad. But, you know, it's a little fatty. You know, it's got some mayonnaise in it. And so I'm going to probably go on a water fast for the next 48 hours or so and hope that it passes. Because, again, to recall Willard Romney's lie, no, there's nobody there to pay that bill if I go and get myself stabilized via a vein full of pain medication. So there you go. To the phones. Hey, welcome to the program.
Hey, Bob.
Well, hey, Tracy. How are you?
Well, I'm fabulous. I don't know where to start. I was listening to your show yesterday, and on my TV flashed a commercial for Atlas Shrugged poop.
Oh, Jesus. Atlas Shrugged, Jesus wept, Bob threw a conniption.
And I just said, oh, okay. So, but there's another movie coming out that we might be wanting to see. Have you heard about it? I'm not remembering the name. It's Matt Damon's new movie about fracking.
No, I'm not familiar, or at least unless I get a name.
Yeah, no, I don't remember. I went to go see Looper, and you know how to do the previews. And I'm like, oh, look! And as soon as they started talking, I told my brother, I said, oh, that's about fracking. And he looked at me like, what the hell are you talking about? I'm like, okay, I got to school my brother on fracking. Onward and on. And my girlfriend just said, what's fracking? So I have to school her on fracking.
And bless your heart for doing it.
I'm going to have a conversation with her about fracking. She's sitting here blushing. It's hilarious. But anyway, why I called, I was listening to you talk about the candidate for, you know, Mr. Willard Romney.
Mm-hmm.
And the vicious lies that he's been saying about medical you know, that the government and whatnot pays for.
Right, and they are vicious lies.
Vicious, because, you know, like you guys, everybody knows that I went through brain surgery and everything, and I have, because I have a disability, I'm on Medi-Cal care. And I wasn't going to apply for Medi-Cal, but I went ahead and did it because of my surgery, because, you know, most of my medical bills were no big deal. Go to the doctor, pay $25 copay, or some doctors didn't even charge me. But when I found out that I was going to have to have brain surgery, I'm like, the surgery alone was going to be $100,000, okay?
Huh.
My surgeon decided, because he knows how much Medicare is going to pay. So he only charged me $50,000, and I had to do the 20% copay. So I had to pay them $1,200, okay? Now, fortunately, I live in the great state of California. So our governor is going to take place part in Medicaid and Medi-Cal and whatnot and so forth. Which leads me to that another lie about, you know, the thing about not so much a lie, what he was saying in the debate about how we should let the state decide, because the states are so wonderful that they have the common sense to decide who gets what. And I'm thanking God that I don't live in, I don't know, Florida or North Carolina or any of these other states that decide that they don't want Medicaid or be a part of the health care initiative, because I would have been screwed. And no grease, no spit, just bend over, spread your cheeks and take it. Had I had to come up with the other money, because at least when I have Medi-Cal here in California, they pay the other 20% that Medicare does not pay.
Right.
And I watched the debate briefly because I'm watching our president's face, and I'm just sitting there looking at him going, I know you want to pimp slap this man. I know. I just wish at times our president would kind of act ghetto and just roll up on these motherfuckers with a gat, a 40, and a Newport hanging from his lip and say, okay, this is how it's going to go.
You're not the only one.
Well, have you ever heard of Key and Peele or Peele and Key?
No.
When you get a chance, YouTube them. They have a sketch show on Comedy Central. My brother.
Oh, okay. Yeah. I know what you're talking. Yeah.
And they have you seen them do... they have the sketch where they have... Well, one of them is President Obama, and the other one is his anger management consultant. And
yes, I saw one of those just the other day.
Oh, MG. Oh, my God.
Yeah.
I just... Because, see, what the one that I saw was when he was addressing the nation, and he said something about the Tea Party, and the guy in the back is like, these motherfuckers are going to say no matter what I say.
Yep.
They're going to say no.
And see, a lot in that same vein, and I have not played it on this program because it's a minefield that I dare not go into because it uses a word with which I am not at all comfortable in any context.
Oh, yeah.
But if one goes to funnyordie.com.
Okay.
One may view a campaign ad, it's of course a spoof, a satire, a parody, of Blacks for Romney.
Blacks
for Romney. Blacks for Romney.
Oh.
If I wasn't afraid, and I am, I mean, you know, I'm a pink guy. I have no business fooling around anywhere near that word.
That word. And you know what? And I, because as a matter of fact, you know, my girlfriend is Jewish. And you know, when I'm talking to my homie, you know, the N word comes out and she's like, why is it that you can, I said, baby, it is one of those things that I cannot explain to you. It's like how I cannot explain why my skin gets ashy and yours don't.
Right, and if there's a sort of a parallel, you will hear me frequently, and it doesn't carry the same freight, and I know that.
Oh, right.
But there's a philosophical parallel at the very least. I throw around the word hillbilly. I encourage people to go to crmw.net and buy a T-shirt that says "Save the Endangered Hillbilly."
Just think, you guys, they are in danger.
Well, and I embrace the word for the very reason that the word was used as a vile pejorative against people from this region for so very long. And from, you know, and where my head is, if y'all want to think we are, then that's what we'll go ahead and call ourselves for your benefit.
Well, it's like Paul Mooney, who I just adore. He's, I love saying the word nigga, it makes my teeth white.
Jesus, Tracy, you're going to get email for me.
Well, I said it. Okay, all America, I am African. Okay, I don't know what the proper politically, correct term is. African-American, black. I used to say I'm an American of slave descent.
See, I like that best of all. In the course of the god awful comments of that freak from Arkansas.
Oh, the one that said that slavery, you know, was the best thing that ever happened to black people.
Yeah, this is Loy Mock, dumb as a rock. What's his name? John Hubbard and Charlie Fuqua. Hubbard's the one that wrote the book about Confessions of a Frustrated Conservative. He's the one that said, the institution of slavery that the black race has long believed to be an abomination upon its people may actually have been a blessing in disguise. The blacks who could endure those conditions and circumstances would someday be rewarded with citizenship in the greatest nation ever established on the face of the earth.
I'm still not considered a citizen. Because
there was a beautiful response. And if you don't mind my reading just a bit of it,
this deserves to be
shared. This comes from a blog called Transgrio. TransGriot. Our buddy Fritz from Arkansas directed my attention to it. That quote that I just read from Brother Hubbard is responded to by this author as follows. What is it with white male conservative fools trying to justify slavery and their vanilla-centric privileged bigotry of African-Americans on a regular basis? The reason I thought of this, Tracy, is when you said I consider myself an American of slave descent.
Mm-hmm. I don't know where
because,
I'm from.
Yeah. As a descendant of an ancestor who arrived in New Orleans in chains in 1810, I strenuously object to your vanilla-scented assessment of America's original sin on multiple levels. I sincerely doubt that my ancestor or others who had the misfortune of being captured and given that less than luxurious boat ride from the mother continent considered it a blessing in disguise. Let's see. You get kidnapped away from your home, marched to a coastal slave castle, loaded onto a slave ship, from there in chains, packed like sardines for the horrific middle passage to these shores or elsewhere in the Western Hemisphere, in which an estimated 2 to 6 million people died during the Atlantic crossing, being sold on the auction block and then forced to work without pay under brutal conditions. Heaven help you if that ancestor was female. In addition to dealing with all of the above, you also had the added trauma of being raped at every stage of the process, in addition to watching the children you gave birth to being sold off. So in your jacked-up line of conservative thinking, John Hubbard, we African-descended Americans should be bowing down to you almighty conservative whiteys for making us the original undocumented workers, forcibly separating us from and erasing knowledge of our African heritage and culture, destroying our families, and bringing us here to do the work of building this greatest nation on earth, so-called God-fearing Christians were too lazy to do. Yeah, right. And about that American citizenship you spoke of, it took a civil war the traitorous Confederate States started and thankfully lost, and the passage and ratification of the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments for us African-descended people to get that citizenship that the Dred Scott versus Sanford case initially denied us. It also took us fighting off white-pointed hooded terrorists, a lot of bloodshed, a long progression of court cases, passage of federal laws, and 100-plus years of agitation organized by visionary community leaders just to be recognized as second-class U.S. citizens. Much of what ails this country in terms of race relations and what ails black America has its roots in slavery. Slavery, along with colonialism, had deleterious effects on the African continent that are still in evidence today. So from where I and every thoughtful African American sits, slavery was, is, and always will be an abomination. Slavery was also a monstrous crime against humanity that we definitely need to be compensated for seeing that we are still suffering the post-traumatic effects from it 150 years later. It's also regular history challenged bigot eruptions like this that not only piss off African Americans and turn us off from conservatism and the Republican Party, but ensure that we'll continue to vote Democratic politicians at all levels of government in this country. And I read that and I went, go. Mm-hmm. And you know, me, a white guy.
Well, here's the thing. A couple weeks ago, I went to visit my girlfriend has only one living relative, and that is her brother up in Northern California. And unlike any of the other women my girlfriend has been with, I actually have an opinion.
Uh-oh.
So we went to visit, and, you know, we hadn't even been in the house half an hour, and he starts on Michelle Obama.
No.
And she got up and left the room. And he's like, I don't understand why she's supposed to. Because I guess there was an interview with her and Diane Sawyer a couple of years back about why people are perceiving her as an angry black woman. He's like, she's too educated to be so angry.
What?
Why?
Huh?
And I said, excuse me? And he's like, what? I mean, why is she angry? She's the first lady. I said, okay. And that's when she got up and left the room. And I said, you know what, let me tell you why she's angry. I said, she is an accomplished, brilliant, amazingly talented woman. And she has people calling her Obama Mama's baby. She is the first freaking lady of this country, and she gets no respect. She's probably went to school with people who were stupid, who got ahead before she did. Because she's black. She lives in a country where it says home of the free, land of the brave, and liberty and justice for all, when she knows damn well it's liberty and justice for some. Okay? Her husband is the president of the United States, and we have people standing up in Congress while she's addressing Congress and say, you lie, sir? You lie? Why shouldn't she be angry? She has
I want to back up a minute and just challenge that word angry for a minute, Tracy.
Okay.
See, anybody who does not bow and scrape before the right wing in this country and tell them that their version of economic anarchy is a gift from God, you know, just like slavery. Anybody who does that is angry, be they white, black, angry, Latino, whatever. But
I'm angry. No, I'm not angry. I'm just.
But beyond that, simply being female and having an opinion is enough to convince right wingers that you're angry.
Mm-hmm.
Unless you're Anthrax Coulter, and then it's okay. Or Laura Ingraham, and then it's okay.
Ann Coulter, whatever. She's a man. I don't care. She has man hands as an Adam's apple. I don't care what. I just, when I hear people tell me that I should not be, you know, when I hear people say, well, why are you so upset? You have a black president.
Yeah, because that makes everything okay.
Everything's okay. We have, you know, we still have young men being gunned down in the streets because somebody thought he was threatening them. I will remain angry. If I have to, you know, I'm listening to Milt Minton saying, you know, the states will make up their mind and do the right thing for their constituents. No, they won't. Because like the letter said, we have to have the National Guard come into these states to let kids go to school, into Arkansas and Mississippi and whatnot and so forth. So you're saying to me, the same states that I was a slave, that I won't have the right to vote because I'm a woman, and all these things. You think they're going to do right by the constituents that don't have money to have a voice? really? What upsets me is the fact that they think I'm stupid. I actually, yesterday, I was calling, but I had to go. I couldn't stay on hold. I actually had, you know, I drive a taxi, and I do Access, which is another program that if, you know, Mittens and his ilk get into office, all these little people running around with the Mitt Romney T-shirts and flags on their little scooters that are being paid for by Medicare and Medi-Cal and all that, they could kiss those scooters goodbye. And all these little programs, like not little programs, but Access and Kids with Special Needs and all this, they can kiss all that goodbye. But yet and still, they're going to vote for Mittens. So yesterday, I pulled up in front of this house. The man saw me. He had his big old Mitt Romney sign and all that in his front yard. And I'm like, okay, Tracy, breathe. As long as they don't talk about politics, you're fine. So I pull up, and I see him, and he sees me. He goes back in the house. You know he canceled his ride?
You're kidding.
I kid you not. You know why he canceled it.
Sure.
I know why he canceled it. And I'm just like, wow. And you are here signing up, because I was picking up, he was an Access customer, which meant that's a federal government program, you know, for Americans with Disabilities Act. Did I mention that he had two brand new cars in his driveway?
Oh,
one being a Lexus and the other one being a Mercedes.
Wow.
And they talk about government subsidies and government welfare.
Maybe those were the cars from the borders he had to take in just to make ends meet.
Right. So yeah, exactly. So when I hear, like, when Mittens is talking about getting rid of PBS, but nowhere did he ever say that he's going to stop subsidies to oil companies.
Right. $44 million to PBS, $110 billion in subsidies to the oil industry. Which would you cut?
Mm-hmm.
That's kind of easy.
Okay. See, that's this new. I remember back in the late when they were coming up with the new math. Now I know where they got the new math from. When two plus two equals, you know, -5.
Right.
It is mind boggling to me. You know, like my mom. I told you she moved to North Carolina, and she's moving back to California.
Really?
She can't take it anymore. She cannot. She's like, you know, I've tried and I've tried, but this state is so backwards. It's just backwards on the way, you know, as a right-to-work state, you know. And I'm still mad that they had the Democratic National Convention there. That's a whole other conversation. But it's one of those states that, you know, when I tell her all the stuff that I'm getting in California, and she's like, I got to come back. Because she's not eligible for anything in North Carolina like she would be out here. It's just sad and scary. Like right now we're trying to get a state proposition passed, because ever since Prop 13 passed here 20, 30, 40 years ago, you know, our school systems have been just decimated. So they're trying to get, a quarter of a percentage of a percent raised on our state sales taxes. They're yelling, oh, it's going to be, you know, so high and this and that. But then I think about the fact that California, we only get taxed, like on sales tax, like if you go to the grocery store, on, like, you know, hot food or, you know, non-grocery items. Perishable food items, groceries, you do not get sales tax on. Whereas in North Carolina, everything is taxed, from the groceries to the whatever. And so when people are screaming about, oh, we can't raise taxes, look, I'll pay an extra quarter of a percent if it means that we're not, you know, cutting classes, if we're not laying off teachers, if kids aren't using textbooks from 10, 20 years ago.
Yeah.
Yes, I'm an angry black woman, goddammit. I am angry. I'm angry because people are...
You're angry, if I may suggest it. You know what? No, you tell me why you're angry.
I'm angry because I'm pissed. I'm angry at... I hate to call people stupid, but I'm going to have to say it. But I don't even know if they're stupid. I take it back. They're ignorant.
No, okay, I'm going to disagree with you. I'm going to disagree with you.
I'm not even ignorant. You know what? I take that back.
No, I'm angry. I'm angry because they are hatefully ignorant. They are, they are dangerously stupid.
And your last caller was about the psychopath and the sociopath.
Yeah, Harry.
Because, you know, I watch a lot of crime TV. And the scary thing about psychopaths and sociopaths and a lot of that, they seem normal. They know the difference between right
sure,
and
if you want to, if you want to know where the highest concentration of psychopaths and, well, more likely sociopaths, if you want to know where the highest concentration of sociopaths in the United States are, they are in the boardrooms of the Fortune 500 and the Dow Jones Industrial Index.
Because they have to be sociopaths.
In order to do what corporations need to have done.
What they do. Because if they had an ilk, an inch, iota, thank you, of empathy, they couldn't do their job. That's why there's whistleblowers. That's why there are people who are in these industries that finally get to that point where I cannot consciously do this job anymore. I know tobacco is poisoning people. I know fracking is wrong. I know mountaintop removal is wrong. I know it's destroying this environment and I get in the health of my fellow Americans and I cannot do this anymore.
Exactly.
You know, I cannot be a party to the sickness that is what, you know, within our country. And like you were pointing out yesterday about there are so many good people in this country that are tired and they want to do something about it, but they can't because they get up every morning, they go to work, working two and three jobs. They don't have time for their kids are raising themselves, and this country is falling apart, but it's all a part of the master plan. And people say, oh, you're conspiracists. No. When we had the strongest time in this country where we had the strongest middle class, people had time to read, they had time to think, and that's why we no longer had, that's why we had the civil rights movement, that is why people fought against the Vietnam War, and all this because they had the time to read and watch and see what was going on and say, oh no, this cannot be, this cannot happen in this country. But now, because they've been working on it, they've been slowly dismantling the middle class. They've been taking away union jobs, and all these people who did not ever have, you know, like I look at people like my grandfather who came out here part of the Great Black Migration to get away from the South and got a good union job, bought his own home, sent my have people going to college and went on vacation.
Yeah,
and these are black people. And they had the time in the 50s and the 60s and the 70s to say, oh, no, this is not happening. We cannot have this happening. But now the only jobs you could get is at Walmart. They're shipping all the good jobs overseas. And if you tell me that this is not part of the master plan about getting rid of, of cutting education, cutting away the opportunities that people like you and me, are, at least we had those opportunities when we were, our kids' age. Our kids, if something does not happen and happen quickly, we are going to all become a part of a permanent underclass. We'll be working at Walmart and only caring about what the Kardashians do. I'm just
saying, well, don't forget Honey Boo Boo Child.
Oh my God, Honey Boo Boo, and now see, look.
Well, look, I mean, the Kardashians don't do it for folks down south.
No.
They need something for the
hillbillies, for the rednecks, for the crackers. And we're still, we got The black folks, what do we have? Because I don't watch reality TV, it makes me puke, but I know there's something that, they're doing for the black folks to keep them occupied. Well, they watch the Kardashians and Real Housewives of Atlanta and what basketball, or the They got a show about the exes of basketball players or football.
Oh, for God's sake.
Oh, my God. Yes, and I just sit here, and then I think about how they're attacking PBS. You know, how they're attacking Big Bird. I learned how to read because of shows like Sesame Street and The Electric Company and all that stuff. Because, thank God, you know, I lived in...
Well, it's like that parody of Sesame Street I ran a couple of nights ago where a very pissed off Big Bird said to Willard Romney, I've been teaching people to read for 43 years. What'd you ever do besides buying a sporting goods store?
Exactly. What?
Willard Romney is not a brilliant man. Willard Romney is just another hustler, okay?
He's a huckster. He's a, what is that, snake oil salesman? He's a rainmaker. He's one of those people that comes into these dirt poor towns when there's a drought and sells them snake oil and said that he's going to make it rain.
You know, that's kind of similar to the hustle that Joseph Smith ran back in the 1820s when he would show up at some suitably credulous farmer's house and say, I have these seeing stones and I can look into my hat with them and they will tell me where the treasure is buried on your property.
Mm-hmm.
But I need a little money to get started. The man was run out of numerous towns.
And that's
the prophet that Bishop Willard Romney reveres. By the way, you got a note from Ron in Raleigh about North Carolina.
Uh-huh.
He says, North Carolina used to be a beacon of progressivity in the South when you consider the rest of the region. The last election brought to power the first Republican legislature since the insurrection of 1898. All the positive advances that the state has made in the 40 years I've been here are rapidly being destroyed. In the upcoming election, we will more than likely seat a Republican governor as well. I'm too old to uproot, so I'm forced to batten down the hatches and weather the oncoming storm like I did 8 years of Reagan and Bush.
And I sit here, and I keep hearing Marvin in my head. It makes me want to holler, throw up both my hands. But the problem is we can't throw up both our hands. We can holler. I'm going to holler all the way. My mom, you know, she's still a citizen of North Carolina. And fortunately, you know, my sister is a flight attendant, so my mother basically can fly almost for free round trip coast to coast.
Right.
She is flying to North Carolina just to vote.
Wow.
That, you know.
Yeah, just to try to make a difference.
Just, I said, because I told her, California, you know, Obama has California.
Sure.
But he needs, if it takes you flying to North Carolina to do what you have to do.
Sail on, you know, yeah, like, yeah, just like Simon and Garfunkel said, sail on Silver Bird. Yeah, go.
Yeah. Go. And it's just, but what troubles me, like you said, those people who come home and just want to keep, you know, their head, you know, keep their heads down and hope that everything is going to be okay, and it's not. It is not.
No.
It is not. It is going to be complete and total bedlam. And I pray. I mean, I seriously fear. For this country, if Romney is elected. When Bush was reelected in 2004, I took to my couch, and I didn't really drink back then, but I should have. But we fared through it. We still got through until President Obama was elected in 2008. We somehow muddled through. But we didn't have this fear-mongering and hatred. I mean, these people, they're sociopaths. They don't care. And when they call themselves Christians, and see, that bothers me as a Christian, because I don't know what Bible they're reading.
Well, I think the real Christians need to find themselves another word, because the Southern Baptists and the Dobsons, they're not going to relinquish that word. Christian has become a dirty, dirty, dirty word.
Dirty
thanks
word.
Thanks to Dr. Dobson.
Thank you.
Thanks to Pat Robertson. Thanks to Joel Osteen. Thanks to that ass-hatted, saddle-bred, saddle-back, saddle-horn, whatever, out there in California. Thanks to all the hucksters and hustlers. Christian, the people who try to walk in the footprints of the brown-skinned Palestinian day laborer, they're going to have to find themselves something else to call them.
Yeah, because, I have...
Because America has come to a realization, I believe, and it's a great number of Americans, 20% of this country is non-theist, agnostic, whatever. That is something like 66 million people.
Yeah.
That's a lot of folks.
And I, you know, and being a follower of the Lord, I'm not even going to say Christian, because, like you said, it's such a filthy word now. I have a friend who is gay who has liver cancer. And her good Christian parents said, well, she might as well die because, well, you brought this on yourself because you're gay.
Oh!
These are her good Christian parents.
Going to be a hot day when they go on.
Man, and I just, I understand, I've gotten into conversations when I've gone out to gay clubs with, you know, gay people, you know, and they're like, well, if you're gay, how are you a Christian? I said, because I love the Lord, and He loves me regardless, and I just go to John 3:16, for God so loved the world, that He gave His only begotten Son, that whosoever believes in Him should not perish, but have everlasting life. There's no codicil there that says unless you, only if you're a straight white male.
Nope, nothing there, nothing at all, and
nothing there.
And Yeshua never said a word about gay folks. Never said not a word, not a word. And if it was bothering him, because he wasn't one to keep his mouth shut. If it was bothering him, you can pretty well bet that he wouldn't shy away from it. Hey, Tracy, I got to run, dear, but it's been wonderful hearing from you.
It's been awesome. But, you know, I might watch the debate tonight for a little while. I can only take so much.
Well, I think at this point I'm just going to go straight to bed as soon as I turn the mic off. I feel terrible.
Well, you need to get you some rest, and you know I'm praying for you. I know you're recovering Southern Baptist, and I'm a recovering missionary Baptist. It's somewhere. The Lord's looking out for you, and I know He is, and everything's going to be okay.
Thank you, Tracy. Thank you kindly.
Love you. I'll talk to you later.
All right. Bye now.
Bye.
And I'm sorry. I'm not just pissing and moaning here. I seldom talk about, you know, feeling good or feeling bad, but, you know, when thanks for nothing, goddess of irony. Ouch. Let's keep rolling. Hey, welcome to the program.
Hi, Brian.
Hey, Granny T?
I'm a Seminata heathen from Tennessee. Is that the right thing?
Oh, Flush Flimball? The oxymoron?
Yeah, I'm a feminazi from Tennessee.
And they're the worst kind.
I'm telling you, one of my docs had gallbladder, and she said, that is an ER condition pain, all right. And, hell, just go ahead and have the surgery and send you all the bills they want to, man.
Yep. Well, I don't know. If they won't do it, they won't do it.
Well, I know, but...
They want money down and stuff, you know.
Yeah.
Easy payment plans, that kind of stuff.
Yeah, well, I got screwed over real good back when, I don't know if you remember HMOs or not.
Oh, I remember. I remember.
Answer to, you know, to everything, and that.
Yeah, we used to call them quack in a shack, dock in a box.
And I was in one of those when I got sick, and that was supposed to be everything, take care of everything. Well, kind of got through with me. I was broke. I'd always done that, got educated, worked hard, and been a good little worker, and all that. And then I happened to get sick, and those efforts left me up real fine, so I have great sympathy, empathy, and everything else for all you know, for all the folks that have to go through this. I sure do.
Yeah, and all it takes is one trip, and, yeah, that empathy lasts forever.
Well, I tell you what, man. Yeah, and and long time ago now, what got me started on this while I was listening to Tracy, I thought about what got me started on that stuff was, I'm so old, you probably don't remember Angela Davis.
I know, yeah.
I saw her in college shortly after she had been cleared of all her charges in California. And a few of my little white friends and I went to hear her speak at, used to be Memphis State University, but now it's University of Memphis.
Right.
And, you know, it's full of black students. And we went in there and we got some suspicious looks and everything, but she said, hey, she put it on that plane, boy. She said, it's not white, it's not black, it's green. Get it through your heads.
Yep, the green people are the ones that are working us over.
Well, yeah. That's the color of it. Who's got the green? You know we ain't got it.
Yep.
So, anyway, and what's your email? I'll try to email you instead of calling so often.
Well, you can call anytime you want to, Granny T, but the email is Bob Kincaid.
Yeah.
BobKincaid at gmail.com.
At gmail.com.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And, and from, you know, that was very, very meaningful to me back then, and I've told you before where I stand on all these issues and what I have fought and demonstrated for and against all these many years. But I have to say the way I cuss now is not the way I brought my kids up.
It's more than understandable. Sometimes it's in the situation and it's unavoidable.
To my mother, she'll be 90 next month, or my siblings, or my children or grandchildren. Even at this time, I feel safe speaking curse words with you.
You know, I take that as a high honor, Granny T.
Well, it is a high honor, and I think you are my favorite. You and Malloy are my favorite radio guys because you verbalize just exactly what I feel and what I would like to say, but in my circumstances here, it would not be good for me to say those things.
I more than understand.
Well, thank you. You are an understanding man. And hell, if we're not headed for a damn theocracy and just right now, then, oh, boy. So I probably will watch the pageant, as you call it. Good word there. Good work.
I don't often toot my own horn, but in this one I will. I think I've landed on something.
You sure got that.
If we
right,
could get the whole country to refer to these as pageants instead of debates, maybe they would realize that they've lost all credibility and they'd start doing something about it.
You got that right. And if they just go to F and fact check after the shift's over, then they might. They wouldn't change their tune because they got their little sociopath minds made up, and that's it. Ain't nothing gonna change them. And so, I'm ready for, you know, back when Perry and a couple of other of the govs around were saying, well, let's succeed. Well, hell, let them get the F out of here and I'll move north. You know?
There we go.
So, anyway, and if I ever get my damn computer fixed up, I'll go on the chat.
Why, they will be glad to see you there, Granny T.
Well, I know we're running short on time here now, and, Jesus, holy Christ, oh, man, I get so mad, oh. Get so mad at what's going on in this country.
Well, like I said, I'm feeling I'm feeling kind of poorly this evening. I don't know if I'm going to be able to stomach it or not, but as bad as I feel, how much worse, you know, how much worse can the pageant make it? So I'll probably fire up the laptop and watch it on C-SPAN or something. I learned my lesson last time. I'll not watch it on any for-profit media.
Hey, man, I haven't had cable since January the 1st of last year. I'm not lying, man. I'm one of those underprivileged persons. I don't know what Honey Child Boo Boo's about, or them Kardashians, or whatever the hell. I don't know nothing about that.
You don't know how lucky you are.
But no, man, I turned my cable off January 1st of this year.
And got clean.
Huh?
And got clean.
Yeah, and I tried my net, but hell, I got to keep my net.
Oh, yeah, no. Lose the cable, keep the world.
Yeah, because I'd be lost sitting out here in the boonies without my internet, you know.
Oh, yeah.
I don't miss the damn TV a bit. I mean, I'm you know, it's, well, you can see my thoughts on that.
I understand completely.
I'm one of them damn grouchy old people that still like them book things.
Yeah, those books, they still speak to me.
Yeah.
I forever got my head stuck in one. Well, now that the Kindle and the electronic formats have come along, they've kind of converted me. I've gotten right fond of them too.
Oh, have you? Well,
yeah, I mean you can download the Kindle reading app on your PC, and there's all kinds of free books out there. There are other e-readers out there. And it's just kind of nice to sit there and turn pages, and I don't know. You can highlight and you can make notes, and you don't have to, that means not writing in the margins. It's kind of convenient.
Well, I might do that then before my little genius nephew. He's been a graduate of Georgia Tech, master's in computer programming and engineering. He's been out Palo Alto for years now, and before the damn things were on the market, he brought one by here, and he said, oh, you're going to love this, you know. He was still undergrad at that time, and I might, but damn if I can afford one.
Well, that's the thing. There's free e-readers out there, and there are tons of free books.
Yeah. Decent books, because this damn old sorry-ass library they got around here.
I don't know. How do you feel about Charles Dickens? How do you feel about Thomas Hardy? How do you feel about you get the idea. Mark Twain. It's all out there now.
I love Mark Twain. Have you read his second edition of his new biography came out yet?
I'm not sure.
The first one came out. Oh, and that reminds me. I hope damn Joe Biden has read. Have you read the two new biographies of that asshole crazy sociopath Ayn Rand?
Oh, yeah. I know more about her than, well, it's probably why my belly's hurt.
It's a couple of new ones by N.C. Heller and Jennifer Berg. That bitch had abortion. The Writers and Artists program that he had, if it was under the WPA or whatever, but she was in that, and she got paid for a play named January the 16th.
I've actually acted in that play as a young man.
Did you?
Yeah, The Night of January 16th.
Uh-huh. Oh, yeah.
It's about the cleverest thing the woman ever wrote.
Well, you are so, oh man, you are so, oh, you are the Renaissance man.
Not hardly.
Yeah, I think hardly.
I just happen to be very fortunate in that there was a vibrant community theater, and it still exists. There was a vibrant community theater scene where I grew up, and I partook of it.
You said one time you grew up in northwestern Alabama.
Yeah, that's true.
How old were you when you evacuated that?
I evacuated the Shoals when I left for college.
Oh, okay. Well,
and then,
so you just grew up your whole lifetime in Northwest Alabama.
Well, the first 18 years of it, right.
Well,
but,
then
yeah, a whole
you
bunch
are
of,
an
yeah.
old South. You are an old South. That's all right.
I sure am. I sure am. And but that's, understand at the same time, Granny T, my dad and my mom were part of the hillbilly migration. They had to leave here to go and find work, and that's where work was in Northwest Alabama for my daddy. But I am the only member of my family to this day that was born down there. We're talking about, I'm basically eighth generation hillbilly, or 10th, or 25th if you count the couple of drops of Indian blood.
Yeah, so did y'all go from Alabama to West Virginia?
3 and 4 times a year.
Yeah. And so
all my friends' parents were taking them to the beach on vacation and taking them out west and so forth.
Yeah.
You know, for the most part, the only when my dad got vacation from the plant, we packed the bags, we put them in the car, and we went to where my parents referred to as home.
And that
we're going home, and that is here, West Virginia.
Ah, okay. So until you were 18, you lived in Alabama, then you moved on back up to West Virginia, right?
Right. Well, I mean, there were a few interregnal periods
I'm
in there.
Well, I'm tired of this, so now
No, that's okay. Went to college in Missouri for a while. Worked at CNN in Atlanta for a while.
Yeah.
I came back to West Virginia in 1983 and have been here with the exception of a couple of years ever since.
Well, I'll be doggone. I know you love your Mountaineers, so you went to college, undergrad.
I'm a proud son of Harvard on the Monongahela, West Virginia University.
West Virginia, and you got your master's and PhD?
No. I've got a bachelor's and a JD.
Oh, you got your JD from West Virginia, too?
Mm-hmm.
Well, I'll be damned. Well,
I did spend a little time down at the Capstone in Tuscaloosa, Alabama.
Yeah?
I qualify as a bona fide been there, went to class Crimson Tide fan. My 2 degrees are from WVU.
Well, you know, I don't mean to be so personal, but you.
Oh, it's all right.
As I have said before, you are one of the most intelligent, well-read men, Renaissance men, that it has ever been my pleasure to find on the radio, and I am so glad that I did. Oh, and there's a very small, unfortunately, if I ever win the lottery, which I don't play because it's such a regressive tax, so.
I understand.
I think it's that tax shit in there, you know.
Well, I mean, I look at the lottery, Granny T, as a voluntary tax upon the unreasonably optimistic.
Well, sometimes we have reason to be unreasonably optimistic when we're ground down to the ground and got no out. But
I feel like I ought to call myself Nub Kincaid instead of Bob Kincaid and just get ground down to a nub.
Well, I tell you what, you're still a youngster, man. If you get your gallbladder taken out, because like I say, my doc said, yeah, that is an emergency room proposition. But got a few little freaking geniuses, or a little niece, graduated from med, UT med school here back May, and a little genius out there in Palo Alto. So, you know, somehow out there in that damn cotton patch, a few little geniuses got out of there, and a stockbroker in Texas, and, you know, I was doing okay until it wasn't a goddess. It was, it must have been some one of them assholes from go rob or grab or whatever it is that struck me down.
Hey, Granny T, you have a wonderful evening. You hear?
Yeah, it's getting toward the end there, Bob. I'll let you go, but I sure do appreciate you, and I'll try to get emails and get try to get on the chat room and not call you quite so often.
You're doing just fine. Don't you apologize. You call anytime the spirit moves you, Granny T.
Okay, Bob. I hope you feel better, and we'll be checking in.
All right. Thank you, Bunch.
Okay.
Take care now.
Bye-bye.
Bye. Granny T calling from Tennessee. I got one more phone call here, and then I'm going to knock off, and we've just about made it through the program, so that works out. I wanted to share something with you that Dr. John told me about. A little moment of ego here, if that's okay. The subject line of Dr. John's email is, how to nominate the horn for a podcast award. I've never heard of the darn things. But he said, nominations for the 8th Annual Podcast Awards are open until 15 October. It's high time the rest of the world recognized the special work that's happening at the horn, thanks to the hardworking host, volunteers, contributors, and listeners. Here's how to nominate Bob and the Horn. Remember, you can submit nominations only once, so make it count. Nominations will be posted for voting on November the 1st. Go to www.podcastawards.com. Nominate the Horn in two categories, People's Choice and Politics News. You need to enter both the name and the podcast URL. For consistency, let's use the name and URL listed on iTunes. Name, The Bob Kincaid Show, URL, www.whiterosesociety.org/kincaid.xml. At the bottom, fill out the two fields in your details, name and email address, click submit, and you're done. That sure would be nice. I don't expect to win anything, but it's nice to be, you know, the joy is in the nomination. Just ask Peter O'Toole. So we'll try to tweet that and get it out on Facebook and put it on the main horn page as well. I'll talk to Agnes about doing that after the show. Sorry to just bellyache about, well, I guess that's the wrong word. Sorry to complain. I'm not one for doing that, but we'll get through the end of the program, it looks like. By the way, as far as the PayPal button is concerned, thank you for the two who have hit it. We are down to $160 is what we need to raise between now and tomorrow night. And knowing that I'm going to be gone next week, that's going to put us behind the eight ball too. It always does. $100 a night is what we seek to raise, but we didn't get anywhere near that last night. So we're looking for 16 folks with $10 apiece tonight. Overall, we look for 250 folks with $10 apiece, but it doesn't have to be 10. It can be 5. I want to share an email with you right quick we got from Kevin in Colorado Springs. After what I was saying about health care and stuff, Kevin wrote in and said, what I'm writing for here from here on is based on what you're saying now. My HHC person's aunt died today in her apartment at the ripe young age of 42. She complained of pain in her leg and left work and went home where the blood clot in her leg broke loose and went either to her brain or heart. I don't know if she had insurance, but it's telling that she went home instead of the hospital. She does have medical personnel in her family whom I'm sure would have told her to go immediately to the hospital. I personally am very scared about this election, Kevin says. My family is mostly Christian conservative, and they've been brainwashed about the Muslim Kenyan in the White House, given no thought to what would happen with a Romney-Ryan presidency. I personally would be left with no Medicare or Medicaid. I've even heard talk about the VA going private under Romney. A Romney win, and I might as well pack it in for all I'm hoping for in the future, will be gone on November the 6th. They wouldn't even wait until inauguration to begin to take down those values Americans have come to expect from that safety net of Medicare and Medicaid. Sharia law? No. We'll have an America run by biblical law with all their love that they show us as they kick us off the rolls of the safety net. What will I do if Romney wins or the election is stolen from us? And I believe that is the most likely scenario. I'm scared to death and Even on Medicare and Medicaid, I've had some of these repig-licking doctors refuse to care for me. That will get even worse under Romney. Does Canada accept political refugees from here? I'm strongly considering it right now, and if Romney wins, I'll begin looking north to avoid the total collapse of America and will not sit still and watch this country continue to nosedive. I will be one of those who will be out in the streets protesting whether or not I get my head bashed in for peacefully protesting and doing nothing illegal except exercising my right of free speech and the right of freedom of assembly, not to mention the right to petition for redress of grievances. Yeah, I'm a dirty liberal, Kevin says, but a proud liberal, an American, and the time just to sit back and allow this to happen unchallenged is long past. And one more thing, Kevin says. I'm going to PayPal tomorrow and to donate the $4 I have left to donate this month. Oh, jeez, Kevin. I would do it today, but my reader HHC person was the one whose aunt died today. Yes, we as progressives have to pay for our progressive shows, but if we let this one in particular go away, then that's one less national voice that continually speaks out against this mess, and if I can, I won't let that happen either. Please, Horn members, don't let that happen today. I've given $40 this month to the show, which on a $1,000 a month disability check is a lot to donate. Yes, it is, Kevin. Yes, it is. We can do this together, but together means all of us, new listeners, old listeners, and in-between listeners like me. Together, though, we can do it. Signed, Kevin. Well, I did have one more phone call to go to, but that one just disappeared. So, not to seem too wimpy or anything, we'll close out maybe a little bit early. Or maybe we'll let the whole Drive-By Truckers song play for a change. It was a long time ago when we started this show that and the Drive-By Truckers blessing and a curse. No, Decoration Day. Decoration Day had just come out. And the very minute I heard this song, the song you hear the beginning of and parts of every night, Hell No, I Ain't Happy, I knew that it just kind of had to be the way we closed the program. And that's before we ever went on the air. It has a special resonance. Because I'm not happy. How can any of us with a conscience be happy when we know that, for instance, in the course of this little 3-hour program, 15 Americans have died for want of access to health care, health insurance? 15. Ain't nothing to be happy about there. So go and watch the pageant. See if the zombie-eyed granny starver put an extra layer of Widow's Point wax on for tonight. Let me know for your thoughts for tomorrow. I assume I'll be okay. This just needs to pass. And we'll hit it for Friday on the front porch. Thanks to everybody who makes all of this happen. First and foremost, you with your kind contributions that keep this going and have kept this going for so very long. Thank you for your calls, your emails, your participation in the chat room. Whatever you do to share those precious finite moments of your life with the Horn family. Thank you. Just got a note from Randy. He said, I've given a total of $50 this month and I'm on disability and I can't give any more this month. And I understand that. I do. This whole effort is sacrifice from everyone involved. And that's why I try to say thank you every night. Thank you to our all-volunteer staff, Lottie and Sparky, the moderators in our chat room. Thank you to our blogger, Texas Betsy. Thanks to our news ninjas of long standing, Gene and Susan. Thanks to my lovely wife, Agnes, for her help in getting the show posts up and out. Thanks to John Fox, web designer, web maintainer, technical guru extraordinaire. Thanks to Ben Birch, WhiteRoseSociety.org. 10 years of saving liberal, progressive internet, radio, and never having sent a bill. And thanks, of course, to the hardest working, bravest people I know, the folks at Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net, and ACHECT, ACHECT.org. Go to ACHECT.org and learn how you yourself can be a part of ending the horrors that are perpetrated daily across Appalachia. We will pass the ACE Act, and when we do, you'll be able to say, I helped make it happen. And always, 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 Gina, Judy, it's all for you.
Made it all the way to the end. Rick Smith is next on the Horn.